Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Okay, so today we're opening the archives on, well, what many consider one of the most essential and maybe one of the most difficult reads in 20th century American literature, Toni Morrison's 1987 masterpiece, Beloved.
And it really is a masterpiece. This isn't just a novel. It feels more like an uncompromising reckoning with American history.
Absolutely. And Morrison, who, as you know, won the Nobel Prize in 93, she wasn't just writing about slavery.
No, her focus was often on the aftermath, the psychological, the spiritual damage left behind. She really worked to give voice to African-American women's experiences.
Experiences often doubly silenced, right?
Yeah.
By the system itself and then by historical accounts often overlooking them.
Exactly. And Beloved is anchored in a truly disturbing, real historical event.
The story of Margaret Garner.
Yes, an enslaved woman who, well, she killed her own child to prevent her from being returned to slavery.
It's an almost unimaginable moral horror. And Morrison takes this core event and transports it to post-Civil War Ohio, 1873.
But what's so powerful, I think, is how she tells it. To really capture the depth of this trauma, she doesn't just stick to straight historical fiction.
No, she blends it. You get elements of, like, gothic horror.
Right, and magical realism. It allows her to explore the internal landscape of trauma in ways realism alone might not.
And we feel that immediately with the setting, 124 Bluestone Road.
Oh, yeah. The house itself is practically a character, described as being palsied by the venom of a baby.
Chilling phrase. It's literally sick, haunted by this spiteful baby ghost.
Which tells you everything about the atmosphere from page one.
So inside this house, we meet our protagonist, Seeth, and her daughter, Denver. And they're living this profound isolation.
Almost total quarantine, really. The haunting isn't subtle. It's driven the community away, driven Seeth's sons away earlier.
It's a physical manifestation of this unbearable past.
It is. Their isolation isn't just social. It's like this deep internal stasis, trapped by memory.
So if we boil it down, the core conflict here isn't just about slavery's legacy in a historical sense.
No, it's about the inescapable nature of trauma itself, how it lives on.
Right. And the question Morrison poses to us, and really to you listening, is how do you possibly live with, process, and maybe even move beyond a past that's, as the book suggests, too horrific to remember and too powerful to forget?
That's the central struggle. That's the mountain they're all trying to climb.
And the climb, or at least the attempt, seems to begin with an arrival.
Yes. The first major turning point, Paul D. shows up.
Someone from Seeth's past.
Exactly. A fellow survivor from Sweet Home, the plantation where they were both enslaved. Yeah. He brings the first real glimmer of a possible future.
Hope, maybe.
Hope, companionship, a connection to a shared past that isn't only horrific. And interestingly, his presence seems to temporarily push back the ghost. It quiets down.
So he represents a chance, maybe, at healing, at building something new.
Potentially.
Right.
But just as that possibility opens up,
something else happens. The central crisis arrives, you could say.
Right. Shortly after Paul D. moves in, this young woman just emerges from the river near the house.
Out of nowhere.
Completely. She's weak, seems to have amnesia, says her name is Beloved.
And we, the readers, start to suspect.
Yeah. It becomes clear pretty quickly. This isn't just some random stranger. This is the ghost.
Materialized.
The baby ghost made flesh. Memory literally walking and talking. The past hasn't just been pushed back. It's knocking on the door, demanding to be let in.
Okay, let's pause here and really unpack these characters. Starting with Seeth, how should we understand her? She's defined by this immense strength, but also this too-thick love, the novel calls it.
That phrase is key. It's this overwhelming, almost destructive maternal instinct. Her horrific act killing her baby came from this desperate need to protect her children from the hell of Sweet Home.
So is Morrison judging her for that too-thick love? Or is she showing how slavery distorts even the most fundamental human bonds?
I think it's definitely the latter. In a system where Black motherhood was basically defined by ownership, by the enslaver Seeth's act, however horrifying, was her reclaiming a terrible kind of agency. Her only way to truly own her children's fate in her mind.
And her internal scars are literally mapped onto her body.
The choke cherry tree, that scar on her back from the whipping, it's described as this grotesque tree, right? A landscape of abuse. But it's also, strangely, a symbol of life, of resilience, deeply rooted pain.
Her journey, then, is about moving from that isolated pain back towards community, forgiveness.
towards forgiving herself, maybe, and reconnecting with the living world. It's a huge task.
And then there's Paul D. You mentioned he's a survivor, too. He represents the male experience of this trauma.
Yes. And Morrison gives us that incredible image for his coping mechanism, the tobacco tin heart.
He locked his feelings away.
Literally. Sealed them up in a rusted tin box in his chest to survive the dehumanization, the constant loss. It's a kind of stoic strength endurance.
But that's not enough for real living, is it?
No. His journey is about prying that tin open. Learning that real strength sometimes means vulnerability, connection. He needs Seeft for that. He says something beautiful about her.
She is a friend of my mind.
Yes. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order.
Wow. That's not just romance. That's the hard work of healing. Someone helping you put yourself back together.
It's profound. And then, of course, there's Beloved herself.
The mystery. The ghost child woman.
She's so complex. On one level, yes, she Seeth's murdered baby return, but she's also consuming, narcissistic even. She grows stronger as Seeth weakens.
And those fragmented monologues she has, they seem to hint at something much older, much bigger.
Exactly. Filled with these images of darkness, water being packed together, it strongly evokes the Middle Passage. So Beloved becomes the symbol for all the unmourned dead of slavery, the collective trauma given a voice, a body.
A history that demands reckoning.
Demands it fiercely. Unprocessed history doesn't just fade away, it festers. And Beloved is that festering wound made manifest. She's incredibly dangerous.
And caught in the middle is Denver, the surviving daughter.
Yeah.
The next generation.
Right. She's grown up entirely in the shadow of 124, in fear, totally dependent on Seeth. Her journey is crucial.
She has to break out.
She has to. Her arc is about moving from that inherited fear and isolation towards agency, towards engaging with the community outside. She holds a key to their survival.
The novel structure really mirrors all this, doesn't it? It's not linear at all.
Not remotely. It's fractured, circular, it jumps in time. Just like traumatic memory often works, you don't remember things neatly, start to finish.
Which brings us to this key concept Morrison introduces, rememory. Could you explain that a bit? It's more than just remembering.
Yeah, Seeth tries to explain it to Denver. She says a rememory isn't just in your head, it's out there. A memory that lingers in a place, like a picture. And other people can stumble into it. You can encounter someone else's past.
So the past isn't past. It's physically present, potentially. Right.
Exactly. That's why it's so radical. It means history isn't safely locked away in books. It's active, it's geographically located, it can resurface and impact the present directly. You could literally walk into Seeth's trauma at 124.
Which makes the past incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
It's not dead, it's waiting.
It can hurt you all over again. And the novel forces us into those rememories back to Sweet Home.
Let's talk about Sweet Home, particularly under the man they called Schoolteacher.
Ugh, Schoolteacher. He's terrifying because his cruelty isn't just brute force, it's intellectualized.
Pseudoscientific racism.
Precisely. He arrives with his notebooks, measuring the enslaved people, listing their animal characteristics alongside their human ones. It's this cold, detached, systematic dehumanization that's somehow even more chilling than simple violence.
Denying their very humanity through logic.
Yes. And the specific violation that really pushes Seeth over the edge, that fuels her escape, it's brutal.
It is nephews.
They hold her down in the barn and steal her breast milk. They take the milk she was saving for her own baby.
It's not just assault. It's an attack on her motherhood, her identity.
A fundamental violation. Robbing her of the very thing that defined her connection to her child. That, combined with the horrific whipping that follows, the one that leaves the choke cherry tree scar, is what makes escape her only option.
And she does escape and finds that brief period of freedom.
28 days. Morrison emphasizes that number. 28 days of unadulterated freedom with her children, living with her mother-in-law, Baby Suggs.
Who preached this radical sermon of self-love.
Yes, in the clearing. Telling former slaves they had to love their own flesh, their hands, their mouths, their hearts, because the world taught them only to despise themselves. It's this incredibly powerful, necessary healing.
That brief taste of autonomy, of self-worth, it makes what happens next even more tragic.
Because Schoolteacher finds them. He arrives in Ohio to reclaim his property.
And Seeth sees him coming. And makes that split-second, horrific decision.
To save her children from him. From Sweet Home, she gathers them in the woodshed and tries to kill them all. She succeeds with the crawling already baby girl.
An act of protection that is almost impossible for us to comprehend. saving them from a fate she considers worse than death.
Exactly. And the weight of that secret, that act, eventually shatters the life she starts to build with Paul D years later.
He finds out, doesn't he? Not from her directly.
No, Stamp Page shows him an old newspaper clipping detailing the infanticide, and Paul D's reaction is instantaneous and devastating.
He's judgment.
He confronts Seath, and he says, "You got 2 feet, Seath, not 4."
Oof. Why is that line so incredibly cruel?
Because in that moment of shock and horror, Paul D, a fellow survivor, uses the exact dehumanizing logic of the enslavers. He reduces her desperate, complex, human act to animal instinct.
Denying her humanity at the moment she needs understanding the most.
Precisely. And that judgment pushes her further into isolation, into her guilt. It creates the perfect vacuum for Beloved's influence to just explode.
So the dynamic shifts again. It's no longer about three people trying to coexist with trauma.
No, it becomes about Seath being actively consumed by Beloved, by her past made flesh.
Beloved becomes parasitic.
Absolutely. In the final bar of the book, Beloved's needs become bottomless. She demands all of Seath's attention, all her energy, all her stories. And physically, Beloved grows larger, pregnant almost, while Seath shrinks, wastes away.
Literally being eaten alive by the past, by the need for penance.
Obsessed with explaining, justifying, seeking a forgiveness, Beloved seems incapable of giving. It's a terrifying spiral.
But it's not the end. The cycle is broken. And it's Denver who does it.
Yes. Denver finally steps up. Seeing her mother fading away, literally being destroyed by Beloved, Denver finds the courage to leave 124.
Breaks the quarantine.
For the first time, really, since she was a small child, she goes out into the community, the same community that has ostracized them for years, and asks for help. It's a truly heroic act of agency.
And that act triggers the climax. The community responds.
They do. Led by Ella, who understands the need for intervention, 30 women from the town march to 124. They gather outside.
And they sing.
They sing. It's not a specific song, more like a collective sound, a rising wave of shared sorrow, strength, and spiritual force aimed at driving out the presence that's destroying Seath. It's a communal exorcism.
A powerful moment of collective action against isolating trauma.
Hugely powerful. But even in that moment, the trauma leaves its mark. As the women are singing, Seath sees Mr. Bodwin, the white abolitionist who owns the house, approaching.
And her mind snaps.
Completely. In her traumatized perception, she doesn't see Bodwin. She sees schoolteacher coming back for her children again. She grabs an ice pick and runs out to attack him.
Showing just how deeply the past has wired her responses, healing isn't need.
Not at all. It leaves permanent fissures. But it's in the chaos of that communal intervention, that confrontation, that Beloved disappears. Vanishes as mysteriously as she arrived.
Gone. The physical manifestation is banished.
Vanished. And what follows isn't a triumphant victory, but a very quiet, fragile recovery.
Paul D returns.
He finds Seath utterly broken, lying in bed, basically waiting to die, believing her best thing was Beloved, and now she's gone.
And he offers that final, crucial affirmation.
Your best thing, Seath. You are. He forces her, gently, to reclaim her own self-worth. Separate from her children, separate from her past actions, separate from Beloved.
Love, again, is the act of gathering the pieces.
Exactly. Restorative. And the novel then tells us the community, to survive, chooses to forget. They engage in this collective act of erasure. Beloved becomes disremembered and unaccounted for.
So if we try to summarize the enduring message, maybe it goes back to Baby Suggs.
I think so. Anything dead coming back to life hurts. Healing demands facing the pain, confronting the ghosts.
But it can't be done alone. It needs community.
Right.
And it needs self-forgiveness somehow.
Right. Which makes that final line of the novel so hauntingly paradoxical.
This is not a story to pass on.
Yeah. Morrison, the ultimate storyteller, writes this story that absolutely must be told, must be remembered. But she ends by acknowledging the survivor's profound human need to sometimes let go of the unbearable weight just to keep living. It's an incredible tension.
It really affirms that true freedom isn't just legal status, it's psychological, it's communal.
And it shows the incredible resilience needed to reclaim your identity, your self-worth, when a whole system is designed to strip you of your very humanity.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.